Abolitionist Frederick Douglass delivered a speech about U.S. politics to an audience of several thousand at Poughkeepsie's College Hill Park in August of 1858. Celebrating the African Spirit, we'll commemorate the event on August 1st, where you can hear parts of his powerful speech recited by acclaimed actor Paul Oakley Stovall. Stovall played George Washington in the touring production of Hamilton, and we welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Paul, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. And just FYI, it's present tense. I return to the role in Hamilton in just a few weeks.
Well, good for you. Now, first of all, I'm saying, is it Stovall? Is that, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah, it's one of those that's so close either way that over the years my mother has said, listen, give people a break. Stovall, Stovall.
Okay.
Both are fine.
All right. I don't want to take off your mom. Also, I should be noted that for local audiences who saw Hamilton while it was here at Proctor's Theater in Schenectady in 2019, almost 2 years ago, you were the guy who played George Washington. So people certainly
sure was,
know you.
And boy did I love playing that for only 2 weeks. But we were able to go to Union College, where Washington had visited.
Yeah.
They have a strand of his hair there. Met the president of the university. Got to visit the Schuyler Mansion. So much history up there.
I do want to get to this event, but you just mentioned something that fascinates me. Did you was that a personal interest that you do in going to the different sites of connecting even more with the character, or is that something that is planned by others? How does that work out?
It's a mix. That happened to be planned by the marketing team. You know, we're often, I won't even say shipped out to things because it is such a joy, but that was myself and Stephanie Umo and Hannah Cruz, who were playing Angelica and Eliza at the time. We were feted at an event at the President's Mansion on Union College campus. And, you know, it's kind of random. Sometimes they'll just choose some of the principals to do something. I think because the Schuyler sisters and George Washington had such a connection to Union College, they took the three of us. But oftentimes I'm just researching on my own. I was very fortunate that the tour was on the Eastern Seaboard for most of the time I was there. And I mean, everywhere you go, someone stops you on the street and says, you know, George Washington ate a peanut right there. You know, George Washington climbed that tree right there, you know? And so you can, but my supervising director said, hey, just focus on the role. You can go down the rabbit hole later, because believe me, our understanding of how deeply these founding fathers affected our nation on a day-to-day basis will become clear to you as you read more books and see more people on the street and historians who have more to tell you. Yeah.
So let's talk about a little history here, which is celebrating the African Spirit is commemorating this event that took place in Poughkeepsie. You are going to be reading the words of Frederick Douglass at this event on August 1st. So give us a sense of how that came about.
Well, I am currently writing an 8-episode limited series about Frederick Douglass's time in Ireland in 1845 when he released his autobiography. Just prior to that, it exposed the horrors of slavery to such an extent that a price was put on his head. Like, how dare you tell the truth about what's happening here? And he was forced to flee. His wife and his trusted advisor, Charles Remond, said, we'll get the letters out ahead of you. You'll go to Ireland. And he, at 27 years old, got on the Cambria ship and risked everything, not knowing what he was sailing into. And instead of staying 4 days, he ended up becoming a sensation and stayed 4 months touring and speaking around the country.
So
because of what I'm doing there, I think a lot of press has been happening. And Frederick's great-great-great-grandson, Kenneth Morris, flew over this last time. I just got back yesterday from Ireland, actually. And he has come on board with the project, and I just think a lot of people are hearing about what we're doing. And so Vassar and Chris Burney at New York Stage and Film reached out to me and said, hey, will you be back, and would you like to do this? And of course the answer is yes.
What do you make of the words that you'll be speaking, and of the speech that he made, and how it likens and differs from his other speeches, not only in this country, but abroad as well?
Well, there's a maturity here, right? You know, we're meeting him at 40 years old, on or about, you know, he never did actually know his exact birthday, but he made a good guess. And he was zigzagging the U.S., and now he has zigzagged the world at this point. He's you know, it's been 13 years since Ireland, which also he went to Scotland, Wales, U.K. His freedom was bought. He's become quite a statesman now. So there's a maturity in it. There is a fearlessness. Now, he always seemed fearless to me. But you know, like when there's a brashness when you're 27 and you're speaking to a crowd of strangers in some foreign land, but now you're on your home soil and you're older and you're more sure-footed.
Yes, absolutely.
You can sense that in the words. Now, and also, I just want the listeners to know, it's a three-hour speech, so you will not be sitting for 3 hours. I think that does no one any good. But no. I do want to say, though, I feel like back then, going to watch a person speak for 3 hours was normal because we didn't have these gadgets in our hands.
Right. And you were
like going to a movie for the night, but I won't be doing that to people.
No, but the oratory was also such that it could keep you
riveted
for 3 hours.
And it was information that you couldn't get anywhere else. And it was information that you could make of it what you wanted and form your opinion. Do I believe him? Is that true?
Right.
I never knew that. Oh, that must be true because he made reference to this. So it was interactive in that way, I believe.
What do you base your performance on in the sense of the way that it was, the intensity, the way that even the parts that you were going to be reading, the way they were conveyed to this audience?
You know, I will give it up to, and I'm very fortunate, playing George Washington in a way, although obviously they're vastly different people, it has prepared me to do something like this because Patrick Vassell, my supervising director, and Tommy Cale on Hamilton, they will say, don't try to play George Washington.
Right.
You can't do that. We weren't there. We never actually heard his voice. Same with Frederick. There's no recording of his voice. So what you can do is put yourself in that situation and see how you would react.
I find that's
the best you can do.
Yes. I find that fascinating. So do you find yourself, I mean, if we're to you, I assume Douglas sounds much different than Washington does.
In my dream space, absolutely. But I only have the one voice.
Right.
You know, I only have the one voice. So you know what I'm saying?
I do.
It just has to come out of me. And fortunately, because I'll be making a cut and an edit and working with Shona Tucker here at Vassar and my collaborator, Nikhil Sabu, who's also a Hamilton cast member with me, we are infusing some music that Nikhil and I wrote inspired by Frederick's journey. So there will be some, you know, I don't want to say distraction. Music is such a joining force in communication that there will be some music interspersed, original content to you know, keep everyone engaged.
When you look at something like this, there's obviously an entertainment quality, but there also is a great historical and educational quality to an event like this. And I'm curious as to how you look at it and because you're given an opportunity here to educate people about this man and about the words that he was speaking and put them into a context.
It's a priority. It's the priority, actually. My mother, who we mentioned earlier, she was an educator. She was a humanities professor. And a lot of the cast members in Hamilton actually will attest to this. One of the things that I do most is after the show, when we go to sign programs, I spend a lot of time talking to the young people about what are your plans with your life? What did you get out of this? I want to get a few questions in besides, oh, the rapping and singing and the costumes are cool. I want to make sure that that the fire is lit, that the pilot light is on, you know? So it's very important to me and you know what? This goes back to why I'm not going to try and portray Frederick Douglass. I need to get the words out so people can hear this was said by this man on this date back in that year in front of who? That's all I need to give them. And then I say, go off to your gadgets and iPads and computers and start digging. you know. But it's, right. it's paramount for me to get it across and not ornament the thing with too much stuff.
And speaking of going to your gadgets and digging, I was watching just the other day in preparation for this of watching President Obama's speech in 2011 that he made on the College Green in Dublin. And he was talking about Frederick Douglass, and as he referred as a great abolitionist, and also the fact that he was able to have a very unlikely friendship with one of Ireland's great liberators, Daniel O'Connell. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, it's actually something that I enjoy most. I've written the pilot episode, and one of the things I do is when Frederick meets Daniel, and I do it, you know, I hit that ground running. It's one of the first things that happens about halfway through the pilot. When they're alone, they shut the door. Everybody, all the assistants go out there, because that's what Titanic people do. So because there is no record of what they said to each other, we can assume what their common ground was. They were both for the liberation of their people. They were both admired each other. But, you know, they may have talked about, so Frederick, have you started putting milk in your tea? It's something we do here. You have to do it. Who knows what they, you know.
Right.
So what I want to do is make it very human and make sure that after we leave that scene with the two of them together, we remember, oh, yeah, they had to breathe to survive. They eat and drink just like us. Anybody could step into those shoes. But that's my task, to not overwhelm and not canonize. That's not for me to do. For me to do is imagine what two incredible people would do when they finally meet each other and can close the door and talk privately.
But you do know the outcome. You know how it affected probably both men, right? I mean, you know about that. There's a lot, obviously, that's been written from speeches and letters and so forth. So you have some sense of what the impact was.
Yes, and I use that to get myself into the scene and to get myself out of the scene.
Yeah.
I do know that Frederick was even reading Daniel O'Connell's speeches at 12, 13 years old, never ever thinking he would ever meet this man.
And what was that like as far as, because he went to Dublin and Cork and Limerick and Wexford and Waterford and Belfast and was speaking, and what were those audiences like? What were they coming to hear, do you think?
Well, I think they were looking for inspiration. You know, he had come to Dublin right at the onset of the famine. It hadn't quite started, but as a professor at Maynooth University, Kieran O'Reilly told me, you could smell the dying crops in the air.
Yeah.
So Frederick would have been very attuned to the poverty and violence in Dublin, the big city, and people, you know, as I've been told, cutting each other's throats with bell hooks over property. I mean, it was not all roses when you got there.
A lot of bloodshed. Absolutely.
A lot of bloodshed. And that was, they were trying to hide that from him, the wealthy, which, you know, listen, when someone comes to your house, you try and show them the room that you already cleaned. You don't, so I'm not holding that against the Irish people. They were trying to put their best foot forward and welcome him. But I think that they were seeking inspiration. I think that, they needed it. And one of the things I discovered is it was the women of Ireland who were at the forefront of the abolitionist and anti-slavery movement. And these women are nameless and faceless and haven't been remembered. So I feel like it's my job to raise up Hannah Webb and Isabel Jennings and Ann Jennings and Susanna and Rebecca Fisher and Mary Ann McCracken, because they were putting in the work. They were politically astute. They were organizing global sugar boycotts to try and shut down the plantations in the West Indies. They were genius, brilliant women. So that has become a part of the story, too.
Well, it's an amazing story. When are we going to see this?
Gosh, you know, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Yeah, right.
I think that Kenneth and I and those that are coming on board in a production development way that we need right now are – we're all on the same page of move methodically.
Yep.
Well, move with purpose, and things will come together in the right time.
Two things. One is I hope that when it is completed, you will come back and talk to us about it, because I would very much, I'm fascinated by this and would love to talk more with you about it. In the meantime, folks can see you on August 1st in Poughkeepsie, celebrating the African spirit, commemorating the speech by Frederick Douglass that will be happening in Poughkeepsie's College Hill Park. And you can find out more by going to celebratingafricanspirit.org. Paul Oakley-Stovall, I thank you very much for being with us this morning.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
Great pleasure. Thank you very much.